Hello and welcome to Translating Heart Intelligence. You are here with Justin and Kenna today. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Justin. I'm happy to be here with you today.
Oh, me too. So what are we going to be discussing today?
So today's episode is about housing as the foundation beneath the monetary system. And we're going to be covering housing and some of the things that I've been working on and sending out to different people. In our last episodes, we covered how to use AI to help write letters to community outreach programs. If you needed help reaching people for sewer lines, example, or water lines.
Mm-hmm.
Our second episode was more about reallocating monies circulating in our system from tariffs and artificial intelligence dividends to help stabilize our current financial system so it can transition to something possibly more efficient and better for everybody. And then our last episode was covering how people can reach out to their, to the treasury if people wanted to start using money reclaimed from fraud to fund their own individual community projects.
Right.
Right. So I did want to give Paul Hellyer a shout out today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I really like that guy. And this is for him. So, okay. Are you ready to? So our first part of this is going to be not housing, but it's all going to tie in together. I wanted to share something that I shared with Justin the other day of how money is very similar to emotion and how both, I found, this is for me, can be detrimental if you don't know how to let it go. So money, emotions, if you don't know how to let it go, it can be detrimental. But the difference that I found was a person would be more than happy to say, I have $20 million in my bank account.
Ooh.
But most people wouldn't ever want to share that they had 20 years of unrepressed self-loathing because, like, their dad never loved them. Like, most people don't.
Oh, yeah. Family issues.
Family issues. Self-worth
issues. Well, some people
issues.
Like to talk about that sort of thing.
Yeah. But so the parallel that I was drawing in between money and emotion is a person could have, let's say, $20 million in their bank account. They can have a reserve of numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally fine if people want to do that. And people can also have, like, reserves of anger or grief or guilt or shame. And that's fine if people want to do that, right?
Yeah.
But there's very little growth if none of that stuff can be let go. If you can't recirculate it, you know?
You mean like having the money work for you?
Yeah, having the money work for you. And because you have to be able to release it back out into the world for it to come back to you in ways, you know, like we've been working on establishing safety in a community or being able to have money restore things in life. Instead of being used to extract it from people. And I think that can also be the same with emotion of when we can let go of things that we've really struggled to process. We can get past that feeling of, well, I'll just never recover because I can't let this go. Sometimes I found that blocks new things from coming into my life. And although this is not related to housing, I felt like I wanted to share a quick exercise that I've taught a little boy that we know. And He struggles with some autistic traits and has a really hard time with emotion. And I've been able to share this with just a few other people, and even though it's really simple, it did help.
Like Mr. Rogers, what do you do with the mad that you feel?
Yep. It kind of works off of that. So what I did with this little guy was, when he'd get really emotional about something, how about we use angry? Usually I'll start making the face of angry, you know, and then if it's not that, we'll make other faces, like, is it sad? And I'll make the actual face, you know, sad. Are you happy? Are we embarrassed? So for this example, once we've landed on the emotion, we'll use anger. We'll sit and we'll say, hello, anger. And then we sit there and we feel it. We feel it in our body. We feel it where it is. So like for me, anger is usually in my shoulders and my neck. If I'm angry, that's where I feel it. Say hello. So we say hello to it. We feel it. And then we say how we want to feel. So with him, usually it's happy. I want to feel happy instead. So we say, okay, hello, anger, feel it. I want to feel, I'm going to say peaceful instead. So hello, peaceful, goodbye, angry. And it's pretty amazing, actually, because I don't know, it's letting your body know that you're acknowledging it and then you're ready to let it go. Sometimes we have to do that multiple times in a row. And even over the course of a couple of days, if it's, you know, if you're dealing, like recently, I was using this technique to get over the death of our dog. And I was actually doing this where I was saying, hello, grief and sadness. And then I felt that one in my, like my chest, my lungs, my throat. And yeah. I was sitting there with it. And I was like, I want to feel peaceful. So goodbye, grief. Hello, peaceful. And for a couple of days, it would catch, the words wouldn't fully come out right. And then I did notice I started going through like the 5 stages of grief a lot faster. But it actually did really help me be able to understand that I needed to let my body grieve and feel. And I needed to feel that for a couple of days before I was even, you know, fully ready to feel peaceful again. So I wanted to bring that up because what I've been noticing in regards to the financial system, the monetary system, a lot of it is very similar to that process, where I've noticed there's so many things going on in the financial system that I would like to change. I would like it to be more reciprocal. I would like for monies to be able to move to people that want to start healing, to be released so that they can grow. And so this is one of the parts of one of the letters that I wrote. So systems like the financial system may also carry accumulated damage long after that damage has already communicated that something needs repair. And we don't need to keep experiencing pain in order to prove that that pain happened. Which is, you know, can be kind of mind-boggling, because when you get stuck in that loop of, I can never let this go, you know, then it, nothing else ever new comes in. What do you think about that? What do you feel? Because you've actually tried the emotional release thing. I mean, do you find any similarities in between both of them? Or,
well, it sounds like I guess I get kind of stuck in with the grief when it comes to the financial system. Is The way that you're talking about housing and the treasury and all of that is how everything is going to all these other different pots that have nothing to do with like growth for us Americans who have paid into that system.
Exactly. I think that's grief is actually like a really good describer. Like, especially, so what I wanted to go into next was this idea that we have a little bit, but it's never been really defined within the financial system, is the idea of a minimum viable home.
Minimum viable home.
Yeah. So that's the idea. So I've been working with this probably since February. When we started having a lot of the problems with our house, I don't know if no one's listened to any of our other shows. We bought a new home and we got the inspections done. And then we found out after living here that we had a major sewer line damage to our home. And we're based in Oklahoma, so the South, many, many other homes deal with cast iron piping, which we're going to go into that more. But through the course of dealing with the homeowner's insurance in regards to our problem, they didn't cover it. Like, that's what we were told. They didn't cover it. It was underneath the home, and it was due to wear and tear. And so it hit me that there is no label, there is no name, there's no definition that is consistently used to name what a minimum viable home is, which for me would be you should be able to use your toilet facilities.
Right.
You should have running water. And you need to have shelter. You need to be able to have protection from the wind and the elements. You know, like that is what a person needs.
So a little bit more of an upgrade than just like a tool shed.
Yeah. Well, so the interesting part, yes, upgrade from a tool shed. Because the interesting part with that is, I was starting to do research into the financial system. What is the foundation of it? Do you think this is a good time to explain the summary of that?
Sure.
Okay. So this is a summary, a very basic summary. I don't want to go too in depth because they purposefully make the language confusing.
They make my brain hurty.
Yeah. So the Federal Reserve isn't literally backed by housing, but the whole financial system that the Fed supports relies heavily on housing. Here is the simple chain. Banks make mortgages. Mortgages become big assets that get bundled and sold. And the Fed often buys those bundles to stabilize the economy. So saying housing is foundational is because the value and stability of homes underpins a ton of the financial system. If housing weakens, everything up the chain feels it.
Right.
Okay, so this is where I didn't understand, because there's no minimum requirement for a home. I mean, I guess you could get something condemned, right? But that's actually really hard to do. I looked into doing that with our house because we were running out of options, and it's extremely difficult to do that.
It would have had to fall through its foundation and pretty much crush us in our sleep. So just kind of ironic, because then we wouldn't have, you know, a house at all.
Yeah. It's very ironic, yes. So as far as the minimum viable home that for us personally, in regards to homes in the South, many of our homes face the same problem, which is the cast iron sewer lines. And these homes were built between the 1940s and 1970s. So the economic question in regards to this shouldn't only be how much does the plumbing repair cost for a home if you're buying one of these homes. It should also be what happens financially if we don't repair it. Because failure to repair these homes, right, can affect habitability, property value, the mortgage itself, neighborhood values, municipal tax revenue, household displacement, and eventual demolition or replacement costs. So we've seen this in homes in our neighborhood.
Well, we see it here. There, you walk down the street here and there are five or six homes for sale that have been for sale for years because they're just not habitable. Or anybody looking to afford that home can't afford all the repair to be done.
Exactly. So you're looking, like us, you're a starter family. You're looking to buy a home, a starter home. You have older homes that were, a lot of the time, if you can afford it, they were not maintained. And that's why they're at a price that you can afford. So you get the mortgage on the house. And then this has happened to so many people where you're looking at, at least $13,000 to $15,000 for your HVAC replacement. Around the same, maybe a little less, around the same for a new roof. Our quote for our sewer line repair to fully rip the floor out and redo everything internally was $45,000. If you do under foundation boring to redo piping, the total for that was about $15,000. So you have all of these maintenance cycles that went undone because a lot of the time the people that owned the home before couldn't afford it either.
Right. Or they jury-rigged everything and made it even worse.
Exactly.
And we're talking about individuals who have aged out of their homes to the point of it was in such disrepair that their only course of action is to sell and get out of it.
Yes. So there's always like those shows on TV that's like, oh, we'll just flip it and we'll make a bunch of money, right? Which that's fine if people want to do that. But what I've been observing, because we've lived all over the country, we've lived in apartments, we've been homeowners. The one thing that I have consistently observed is that there are regional problems all over the United States, especially in around the 1940s to 1970s, where a lot of the starter homes, a lot of infrastructure was built around that time. And a lot of them have not been able to be maintained. And so if you have that aging couple that lived in that home, they paid it off. That's awesome. But it got to the point where they couldn't afford to maintain it anymore. Or let's just say you had a family that couldn't maintain it. That's what gets passed down to people. And that is what I called deferred maintenance, which is the physical cost of not being able to maintain a home.
Right.
Right. So what is deferred maintenance have to do with the Federal Reserve, right?
Right.
Deferred maintenance means many homes, if there was a minimum viable housing standard, where you should be able to use the toilet. You should have adequate wind protection from your roof. You should be able to have running and clean water. None of that's been established. So when the Fed says they have all of these home assets that back the housing market, how many of those homes, this was my question I sent to them, how many of those homes are actually livable? And I think, like, I actually was able to get a response from them, but I'll probably go into that because we also need to talk about homeowners insurance.
Yeah, that
in
was
in regards to this, because homeowners insurance is required if you have a mortgage. So it's all tied together. So the Federal Reserve uses housing to back its financial system. That's its foundation. They use mortgages to do that. Okay, and so when you have a mortgage, you have to have homeowners insurance. So in our experience and many, many, many other people's experience, homeowners insurance is not paying out on claims. So essentially, they're not paying to maintain the home so that it can be viable. Does that make sense? What does that mean to you?
Right. And I think part of that service, you're paying for a service.
Mm-hmm.
And when you pay into it for decades, kind of like our situation, and then never end up using the service, and when we end up needing it, there's absolutely nothing that will be done.
Yes.
Because I guess I guess it's going to sound kind of bratty, but, you know, as the homeowner, it is our responsibility. However, in our case, even if we got the inspection, even if we got the scope done, we still wouldn't have known about the problem until it was way too far gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the first letter I sent out was actually to the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety on March 10th. And the question that I asked them in regards to this whole problem was, can we scientifically test whether targeted intervention and repair improve the survivability of existing housing? And I asked if they could discuss things such as durability, insurance outcomes, preservation versus abandonment, and whether the property remains a functioning asset. The IBHS, which is the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, responded and indicated the concept had been forwarded internally for possible research consideration without presenting that as a commitment that they would do it. I just wanted to know if it was even possible for the insurance company to understand that repairing homes, you have to be able to repair homes in order for homes to exist for the future generations.
Right. And that was a big part of that, the letter that you sent in.
Yes. Insurance was very good at pricing sudden catastrophic events. But what happens when the catastrophe is a slow deterioration? So this is where we were talking about earlier, where we have a bunch of homes in our area that are literally abandoned. And the next part that I sent in to, along with this, to the IBHS, asking if they could study the repairing versus abandonment, what the question I asked was, how much money are the homeowners insurance companies losing out on after they've let a home be abandoned. So you've let this property, so you haven't helped out your people who've been paying into your insurance, right? Mm-hmm. You've been keeping that money for yourself and your business, which is a business model. I get it. But how much money are you going to be losing out in the future for all of these homes that are going to end up a likelihood of being abandoned because people cannot afford the amount of money it is to bring that home back up to minimum viable habitability?
Right.
And it was staggering. The number was absolutely staggering. I started doing research on how many homes just for fun. Sorry, I'm finding my notes.
Yeah, the numbers of their losses versus the numbers of their gains, right?
Yes. So, all right. From the census data, it was 56 to 59 million homes in the South built between 1940 and 1979 had cast iron. So an average of that huge number of homes, of 57 million homes, the time they were built, how many were still likely to have cast iron plumbing, and the ones still containing original and vulnerable, inaccessible portions, like our home, we had to go underneath the foundation, right? I was doing all these calculations with the AI.
Yeah.
That's at least roughly 4.9 million homes that are going through the exact same thing that we are going through right now.
Yeah.
With the census data, with the trajectory and the lifespan expectancy of how they built these homes. That's a lot of people going through a lot of hardship right now. And not to mention just homes, right? But the infrastructure. We already talked about the water lines, water mains bursting that are cast iron. It's a really big issue. And it's only a regional issue, right? Mm-hmm. That's only one small portion of this. Other regional issues that we came into contact with, we lived in the Pacific Northwest. Mold. We lived in old apartment buildings in the Pacific Northwest, and every single one of them had ridiculous amounts of mold. In Idaho, especially North Idaho, mold was a huge deal. And to remediate that takes so much money. And the likelihood, if it gets too far, because I used to deep clean homes for a rental company, the likelihood of removing mold once it gets past a certain point, you just can't do it. So then you have to decide, is this viable to save or not, right? What do you want to go over some of the regional things we saw in New England when we lived there?
The biggest thing in New England was the foundations. Well, it is the oldest place in the United States, and they use a combination of vermiculite in their foundations, which crumble and turn into sand over time. And the local governments knew about it. They actually passed that law in Connecticut?
Yeah, it was like
reimbursement.
Yeah, in Connecticut. They did not in Massachusetts, though.
No, and not in Massachusetts. But the sheer fact of the matter, we were looking at a repair of almost $250,000 just to redo our foundation. And after we put in an insurance claim and all of that, they I'm not kidding you, they literally told us that it has to fall down on top of us before they would do anything.
And that was for our previous home in Massachusetts. That was what we were told, because the insurance company said that it was wear and tear and that they did not cover wear and tear.
No. So even though we did what we could for structural support, according to licensed engineers, and we had several come out, it was just going to be a major issue.
Yes. And a lot of them, you know, I think a lot of people, I mean, what do you could get a second mortgage if your home is paid off, or you have to let it go, or you could just let it go to foreclosure, walk away. Like, because for a person, once you hit that point with a home, I don't know, for us, it felt like we were trapped. And we were like, we're tied to this asset that has not been maintained. There's no accountability for wear and tear. There's no help. We either have to go to the bank and double down almost the exact same amount that our initial mortgage was, be stuck here forever, or we try to remediate as best we can, which we did. We had like masons come out and do a buttress, which was, you know, going to help the foundation last longer and allowed the home to still be sellable.
Well, and so the big day, they want us to, you know, buy homes, make families, and keep the economy going. But they could also, this is the big thing that you're talking about here, is they could also work to help support us so that we could stay in a minimum viable, livable, you know, dwelling of some kind.
Yes.
Because I think we would have been over the moon if we could have gotten the help and we would have ended up staying there.
Yeah. And we would have, I mean, we wanted to be a part of that community. But we could, like, raising children, going to work,
staying in the same area, keeping that local economy going.
Yes, you know, but we could not afford the price of that home.
No, you even did the math, right? It was actually cheaper to just bulldoze it and build up a new home than it would have been to try to fix the foundation problem.
And that was exactly what I sent to the IBHS too, was I asked, when for a home is too far, because we also can't total a house. So you can total loss a car, but we can't total loss a home. So that was all stuff that I sent into them. Asking those questions, they do tests for all the insurance companies like that to figure out what is actually coverable, where do they save money, what helps when they pay out on it. I mean, they're like the people that actually talk to all these insurance companies. What that ties into next is we have homes that we have no way to distinguish if they're habitable, but they are considered an asset and they are considered a foundation to the entire financial system. And this is where I was exploring how the Fed moves money around. How is it using this foundation to do what it does, to control interest rates and print money? So I got a lot of notes. Sorry, give me a minute.
Okay.
So if the government or Fed can pay billions of dollars in interest to financial institutions, specifically to influence business behavior or lending practices, could a monetary system be designed to influence behavior through other kinds of payments instead? So our current approach that I've observed is we go through inflation, which means the cost of borrowing money, getting a loan goes up. The interest rate goes up. Everyone feels the pressure and the demand falls for people wanting to borrow any type of money, right? If I was, you know, wanted a more empathetic system or one that was more of a container for growth. It could go inflation still, but we have better methods to identify where the pressure is originating, constrain the destabilizing activity, protect essential capacity, and give households more time to adapt. This is the exact same thing that we did with our home in Massachusetts, which had foundation problems. So we had this overwhelming problem of the entire foundation. We were able to find a way to have buttresses installed, which are, that's a funny word, but they're just, you know, stabilizers to hold the walls up so that the home can still be livable.
Right.
And it gives us some more time to figure out, okay, what are we actually going to do? So this is just asking if there's a way to do that, but on a much bigger scale. And I think the other question that I really wanted to convey to people with the show today is if our participation, if public participation makes the financial system possible and valuable, shouldn't some of that financial return that's generated in between the Fed working with the Treasury be returned to the public? I mean, our homes that we live in, the money that we pay them is literally the entire foundation and basis for this monetary system. And what portion of financial return represents compensates the American for their actual risk and service and time? What portion of this arises because everybody collectively maintains the monetary container? Where is this money coming back to us? What do you think? Well, you brought up taxes.
Well, that's how it was supposed to work, right? You pay in your taxes and then it goes into, fixing roads and paying firefighters and which, you know, it's all very important. But right here, you're talking about setting up a, correct me if I'm wrong,
okay,
setting up another system of, you know, monetary distribution,
mm-hmm,
for people to be able to not only to stay in one place, to be able to fix our homes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people don't have to stay in one place, but if they do, they should be able to fix their home and repair it. Or a new family, a starter family, should be able to come in and have a home. Everybody should be able to have a home, I think. And I think that there needs to be accountability for what a minimum viability should be for habitability.
Because it's already difficult enough where you have to save up for a $50,000 down payment and then sign a 30-year mortgage, 6% interest, which doubles the loan over the course of the 30 years.
Yes. Well, so that's my idea. So I sent the stuff regarding the homeowners insurance and the minimum housing viability to the IBHS to start researching that. And what I did next was I started working with how do I communicate with the Fed all of this information and where could money come from in the system that we're already using to give back to people, to be able to repair their own homes, and essentially repair our financial system, make it more reciprocal and way less. This isn't something that I wanted to be controlling. My intention with this would literally be all of this money is being used in ways that are not for you normally. It's being, we made a joke about that a while ago, last show, where they always talk about, oh, all these millions of dollars are being sent for these crazy things to other countries. You know, it's also very similar if you look at it that way. When, like, you get guilted by your family to go to some event that you don't want to go to.
Yeah.
You know, but you still go anyway. So all this money gets sent to these other countries anyway, when it's like, wait a minute, hold on. Maybe we can slow down a little bit and figure out, can we actually use some of this money to fix our country and our homes? So instead of using, should I read the other descriptor of this? Sorry, I don't want people to.
Yeah, sure.
This is a lot of information, so.
Instead of sending the $200 million to South American dance lessons, you know, like.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to try to explain the summary of how money moves between the Fed and the Treasury. That's where a lot of those funds, I mean, for the dancing lessons, that's how they allocate those funds out. So the Treasury is the government's bank account. It collects taxes, pays bills, and issues Treasury bonds to borrow money. The Federal Reserve isn't a piggy bank for that. It's basically the system, the financial system stabilizer. It buys and sells things like treasury bonds or bundles of mortgages to keep credit flowing. So money flows in this big circle. People, banks, housing, markets, Fed operations, government spending, and back again. So it's not literally the Fed sends money to the Treasury and back. But if we could try to picture it in this loop, it can help it. It's easier to understand.
Yeah.
I think. So using some of those funds, I wanted to propose a housing stability reserve funded from a defined portion of Federal Reserve net earnings, and they call it remittances, or a multi-year average or fixed share of eligible Fed Treasury monetary revenues or monies.
Yeah.
If the monetary system earns a public system surplus, part of that surplus should maintain the minimum physical stability required for citizens to participate in the economy at all. Like, it should be that simple.
It should, yeah, you would think.
So just as an example, and this was pretty eye-opening to me, and I was using the AI to help me figure these numbers out. Between 2020 and 2024, the average money the Fed remitted to the Treasury was $54.6 billion with a B dollars. If only 25% of that money was used for a housing stabilization fund, 25% of that would be $22.5 billion with a B dollars annually from just that average. So looking at starter homes and deferred maintenance costs, the financial debt, the mortgage, is recorded in the banking system, right? But the physical debt, what we've been talking about, the deterioration accumulated in the structure, is not being covered. And there is all of this money literally being sent away to other things that literally could be used to help people repair their homes and restabilize our entire financial system in a cyclical way. Like, this doesn't have to be just like a boom, one and done, because as we talked about before, different regions in the country have different problems. You know, there's ways to stair step and triage where the worst of the worst is, because those are the areas where starter families, the future, is going to have a really hard time flourishing. That was another thing that I brought up with the Fed was, how do we expect people to be able to keep participating in this.
If we can't.
Which, if people don't want to use a financial system, okay. But the reality that I feel and I look at is everything that we do is tied to that. All of our security, all of our comfort, our food, like all of our survivability. We talked about that before. All of the survivability for us and our children is intertwined with that. So before it completely falls apart, I wanted to try to offer a bridge to somewhere better, somewhere where people can actually have reciprocal care given to them just for existing and participating with these systems instead of letting it just keep extracting from people. What is that? How do you feel about that?
I'm thinking of a different type of analogy because we were talking about emotions earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the movie Yes Man with Jim Carrey?
Yes.
Okay, he was not a bank teller, but he was a guy that approved or disapproved loans.
Mortgage officer.
Yeah. Well, no. Yeah, sort of. But I guess it's the emotion tied to the scene where he thought he was about to be fired because he approved so many microloans. But it turns out that the customers were so more than happy to receive those microloans that they paid everything back in full. And I guess it's the emotion behind that is kind of what I'm thinking about. I don't know.
When I wrote all of this to the Fed, I don't think people should be charged interest to fix the foundation of the financial system for whatever money they would receive. But I think that's a great example that I think people would be more willing to participate if they were actually able to get something in return that helped them stabilize their life so that they could continue growing. And so that's what Jim did, right? In the movie, was he was helping people stabilize their life so that they could keep growing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the whole point of this is with all of the deferred maintenance, there's been a lot of things that were not, the intention was not to leave it better than when you found it. And how do you repair that? That's essentially what's going on here. How do we give people a shot at repairing their own communities, their homes, and their world? Is there money there? Is there anything already existing that can do that or serve that purpose, right?
But the sheer amount of money out there is absolutely mind-boggling. Like,
yes.
It's just what you're talking about here is reallocating.
Yes. So in my main letter to the Fed, I brought up the idea, too, of the minimum viable habitability, how that is a financial stability issue. I asked them about preservation versus abandonment economics, mortgage collateral deterioration, the effect that that will have on our future. Because the more homes that are abandoned, all of that, they're literally losing out on all of, not only the homeowner insurance people are losing out on all of that money that they could be using to pay their employees and pay out to other people for continuity of repair, but all the banks are going to be losing out on all of this mortgage money. And that goes up, right? That all goes up to the main system itself.
Right. And I think we're about to be leading up to that is part of what you have discovered is it's actually more cost effective for the insurance companies to be able to pay out for these fixes for the longevity of the homes than it is to just let everything go into disrepair.
Yes, that was a huge bulk of what I sent both to for the homeowners insurance, the IBHS. That was a huge bulk of what I sent to the Fed was a bunch of different examples, mainly the cast iron example of all of these homes. Of it is cheaper to take the time, repair it now. And I made like a whole table, you know, of like the example that we shared right at the beginning of the cast iron sewer lines. A lot of the time it is cheaper to repair it than just let it be abandoned or have to be bulldozed and rebuilt. And, you know, I did get a response back from the Federal Reserve when I sent it into their email. I sent it to the Federal Reserve board members. I did get a response back. They asked me to actually reach out to some of the Federal Reserves in the South. So I reached out to the Federal Reserve of Dallas, to some of the economists there, so that they can start asking these questions and doing the research. And I think once you see something like this, of the continuity of the whole structure relies on something that hasn't been repaired. So the physical homes haven't actually been repaired. They've just been labeled as an asset. But what actually makes an asset valuable is being able to contain life within it. And, you know, that I really hope that people get something out of this, because asking these big questions is possible. Translating your ideas is possible. And being able to voice your opinions to the people that might feel like they're completely out of reach, it is possible.
It is, yeah. And keep bugging them, too. You'll get a response eventually.
Yeah. Well, do you want to finish with this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, with me?
Yeah.
So we don't have to preserve every emotion forever in order to honor what it is taught us. And we don't have to preserve every physical component of a house forever either. Sometimes the pipe gets replaced. Sometimes the roof gets replaced. Sometimes an old system gets replaced. The goal isn't preservation of every piece. The goal is continuity of the living container. Maybe sustainability is learning what needs to be released, what needs to be repaired, and what is valuable enough to keep carrying forward.
Yeah. I feel like that was our goal today for the show. And before asking a household to produce, borrow, consume, save, or participate in the economy, there has to be a viable physical container underneath that participation. And I feel like everybody deserves that. So, awesome. I feel like that was good for housing today. That was a lot of information.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to thank you for being here with me, Justin. And thank you to the listeners out there and to BBS Radio for hosting our show today. Our next episode, I wanted to talk about some of the ideas I sent in to the Department of Transportation in regards to infrastructure changes and transportation. So your idea that we sent to the Department of Aging of Oklahoma.
Yeah, I'll try to be nice about that one. So
yeah. And then right to repair. So I also sent in a bunch of things to automotive companies, to all over Home Depot, for people to be able to have the right to use what we have available to repair what they have, and not always having to reach outside themselves to other systems or companies to do that. So thank you for being here today. And
thank you. And as always, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.